Lecture 5, The Rosetta Stone, and much more.
Hello again. Let me do a brief summary of what we did last time because it leads directly into what I want to do today. Remember we talked about Napoleon's campaign when he went off to Egypt and how he didn't just go for a military expedition. He took with him 150 scientists to study Egypt as it had never been studied before. No one had ever done anything like that. Now, what his campaign would be was a military disaster. He lost badly. But modern Egyptology came out of it. And in particular, we're most grateful for the Rosetta Stone. And that's what I want to talk about today. And I have a specific goal today. I'm even going to give you a little bit of homework. But don't worry, it's easy. Today, I want you to understand why the Rosetta Stone was the key to the decipherment of ancient Egyptian language. And I want you to know the different scripts that ancient Egyptian was written in. It was written in a hieroglyphic script, what's called a hieratic script, a demotic script, a Coptic script, all words that you probably haven't heard, but that's okay. But by the end of the lesson, I think you'll understand them quite well. And my prediction is, and my goal is, that every one of you will be able to read and write your own name in hieroglyphs by the end of this lecture. So, let's see if it works. Now, let me first explain why ancient Egyptian became a dead language. Towards the end of Egypt's long history, 3,000 of years of historic records. Towards the end, Egypt was conquered by many foreign lands. And we'll talk about those later. The Assyrians, the Libyans, the Babylonians, the Nubians, towards the very end, the Greeks, and then finally the Romans. And because Egypt was eventually occupied by foreigners, the language died out. At one point, Greek became the major language of commerce. Then the Romans took over. So by 425 AD, we have the last inscription written on a wall in a temple in ancient Egyptian. That is the last time that we know that anybody could read or write ancient Egyptian. It was probably a priest. So after 425, no one could read ancient Egyptian records. And it remained a dead language. It remained a dead language for over 1,000 years. Now, why? The answer is that everybody was making the same false assumption, that it was picture writing. Now, think about it. Don't most people think of hieroglyphs as picture writing? That when you see birds and feet, like maybe you see feet walking, and it's talking about somebody going somewhere, perhaps, and when you see birds, it's talking about birds, and when you see snakes, it's talking about snakes? No, that's wrong. Ancient Egyptian was basically an alphabetic language like ours. But everybody was assuming it was picture writing, so nobody was deciphering it. Interesting, by the way, think about this. If it really were picture writing, wouldn't we all be able to read it? Right? We'd all be able to read it. But no, it's not picture writing. It's mainly alphabetic. So for over 1,000 years, nobody could read or write it. There's a lot of speculation, I'll tell you that much. One Greek writer who had an interesting name, Horapollo, Horus and Apollo combined, right, a Greek, wrote a treatise about ancient Egyptian hieroglyphs, but he couldn't read them. He had no idea. And it's an interesting treatise. He got some things right, some things wrong. I'll give you an example. He says, and this is right, this is the right part. He says that a duck, when you see the hieroglyph of a duck, it was used by the ancient Egyptians to indicate someone's son, S-O-N, the child, that a duck represented a son. He was right. He was right. The reason he gave was, thinking of picture writing, because the ducks fight so fiercely for its offspring, the duck was associated with children. That was really wrong. The duck indeed did represent a child, a male child. But the reason the duck represented it was that hieroglyph. And remember, it's a hieroglyph, not a hieroglyphic. That hieroglyph, it's a picture of a duck, merely is there because it's pronounced S-A. The duck represents a sound, sa, and that was the ancient Egyptian word for son. So when you look at a duck, when an Egyptian looked at a duck, he wasn't thinking about a duck. He was thinking about the sound sa, and that meant a male child. Right? So Horapollo had some right, some wrong, but there was an awful lot of speculation about what these sacred carvings meant, but nobody really knew. Now, the Rosetta Stone. As you'll remember from last time, it was found at a fort, Fort Rosetta. Napoleon's men were digging the fortifications, and buried into the wall of the fort was this stone, the Rosetta Stone. So whoever had built the fort originally took this old stone that was around, good piece of building material, recycled it, put it inside the wall. Bouchard, the lieutenant who found it, was an educated man, saw there was Greek on it, saw there was ancient Egyptian. He knew this was going to be the key. And as I said last time, it was sent down to Cairo, and the scientists started studying it. Now, first, your trivia question, your Egyptological trivia question. How many languages on the Rosetta Stone? You've all heard of the Rosetta Stone, and I bet in high school you were taught, and I bet you were taught three. That's wrong. The answer is only two. There are three scripts on the Rosetta Stone, but only two languages, Egyptian and Greek. Those are the languages. But the Egyptian is written in two scripts. You know what it's like? We have, say, printing, printed letters, Latin letters we call them, and cursive writing when we were writing a letter. That's what the Egyptians had also. They had different forms of writing. And on this Rosetta Stone are three different scripts. We have one, which is hieroglyphic, the hieroglyphic script. These are the hieroglyphs. These are the symbols that are recognizable as ducks and birds. This is what you can tell. Now, in addition, the Egyptians had other scripts. One was called Demotic. That's also on the Rosetta Stone. Now, Demotic, again, comes from the Greek. It means demos, for the people. This is the people's writing. So, in other words, hieroglyphs, the sacred carvings, are used by the priests for religious texts and also used for official big statements by the pharaoh. When you put something on a temple wall about a victory, that was in hieroglyphs. But if you were writing, say, a laundry list or a grocery list or a receipt for goats, you did it in Demotic because it takes a long time to draw a bird and then a foot. And then so they had a quick way of writing it at the end of the Egyptian civilization called Demotic. So that also was on the Rosetta Stone. Now the third script and the second language was Greek. And that's one that scholars could read at the time. And the key was the last sentence of the Greek. It says, and I'll read it to you, written in sacred and native and Greek characters. In other words, that last line of the Greek inscription said, we've written the same message three ways. In sacred, hieroglyphic, native, meaning the people's writing, the Demotic, and Greek. So it was the same message written three different ways in two different languages. This was going to be the key to deciphering it. Let me say this. There are other forms of the Egyptian writing. There's one other important one for us called hieratic. Right? Again, sacred writing. This is a more cursive form of writing also. It's something in between Demotic and hieroglyphs. So, for example, instead of writing the full bird, you might just write its head and then its tail feathers. So it's a quicker way of writing. So you have different scripts. You have the fancy one, hieroglyphs, which takes the longest. You have hieratic, which is pretty fast, and Demotic, which is really fast. There is even one more script in Egyptian history. And let me tell you about that one, because it's going to be the key to the decipherment of hieroglyphs. Coptic. Now, Coptic, it comes from the Greek word. Right? Eventually, it comes from the Greek word for Egypt, Egyptos. And Egyptos became Copt, and that's Coptic. The Copts in Egypt, and they're there today, to this day you have Copts in Egypt, are the Christians, the Christian Egyptians. In the first century A.D., St. Mark came into Egypt preaching the Trinity. Now, he was spreading Christianity, and the Egyptians adopted it very easily. For two reasons. One is, first of all, almost all Egyptian gods come in threes, in trinities. For example, in the town of Memphis, there was a trinity of the god Ptah, his wife Sekhmet, who was a lion-headed goddess, And they have a child called Nefertum, who's a lotus god. Comes out on a lotus. So they come in Trinity. You have a father, a mother, and a son. In Memphis, those three. In Thebes, in the south of Egypt, you have another three. You have Amun, who starts out as the hidden one, remember, in the primordial waters. His wife, Mut, who also has a lion head. And they have a child, Khonsu, a ram-headed god. Another trinity. So St. Mark comes in and says, I'm preaching a trinity. The Egyptians were ready. There's another reason, though, why the Egyptians could adopt the Christian trinity. The Egyptians had a history of polytheism, believing in many gods. They never felt they really had to choose. You know, one of the things that people forget is that monotheism, the belief in one God, is divisive. If you believe in one God, then it's really, I'm right, and those who don't believe in you are wrong. So monotheism, in a sense, is divisive. Polytheism, if you can believe in lots of gods, it's a lot easier in a way. And the Egyptians never felt they had to choose and pick and throw out gods. So St. Mark came in and he said, I've got a trinity. They said, fine. And they adopted the trinity. So these people who converted are called the Copts from Egyptos. Now, their language is Coptic. But here's where it gets interesting. St. Mark comes in with Christianity. Says, okay, you guys, you've got to change your religion. Going over to Christianity, we've got a new trinity for you. But you can't use these pagan hieroglyphs anymore for our Christian religion. So the Egyptians, they're still speaking Egyptian, but they're not allowed to write their language in hieroglyphs. They need a new script. It happens at this time, the Greeks had been in Egypt for many years, centuries, ruled for three centuries. So Greek was around as a language, and they chose to write their ancient Egyptian language in the Greek alphabet. So Coptic is really ancient Egyptian written in the Greek alphabet, just kind of spelled out phonetically. That's the last script that we have of ancient Egyptian. Coptic, of course, doesn't appear on the Rosetta Stone, but as you will see, it is the key to deciphering hieroglyphs. Coptic is going to be what does it. Now, so now we've gone through the different scripts that ancient Egyptian was written in. Hieroglyphic for the fancy religious texts and official things. Hieratic, if it's a little bit faster, has to be written. Demotic, language of the people, written very quickly. And we have Coptic, the language of the Egyptians during the Christian period, written in Greek. Now, the decipherment. As you remember from last time, the Rosetta Stone was taken by the British. They won the war. And the Rosetta Stone is in the British Museum today. You can all visit it. I'll tell you something neat, by the way, that the curator, a friend of mine, Harry James, who used to be the curator, did. It's a stone. It's a large stone. It's about this big, you know, maybe 3 feet high, solid. It isn't black. It isn't black. Everybody thought it was black for 200 years. It's not. It's kind of red. And it's not basalt, which everybody thought. It's granite. Recently, last couple of years, they were cleaning it, right? It had gotten kind of dirty. And as they cleaned it, they realized there was an awful lot of black ink on it, perhaps from the original inking of the stone when they were making the copies. But then they discovered underneath, it was pinkish. And it's not really black basalt like everybody thought. It's pink Aswan granite. It comes from a quarry in Aswan. They even figured out where the quarry is. So it's not. But anyway, my curator friend, Harry James, who used to be the curator at the Egyptian wing of the museum, decided that everybody should be able to touch the Rosetta Stone. It's kind of neat to be able to touch a bit of history. It's a hard stone. It's not going to hurt it. So it's on display with no glass covering it, and you're allowed to touch it. You can really touch a bit of history there. But it's in the British Museum. But it is going to be, as you will see, the key to the decipherment of hieroglyphs. Now, let me say this. Who deciphered the Rosetta Stone and the hieroglyphic language and the Egyptian language in general is a bit of a conjecture. People argue still about it. The main decipherer, there is no question, is a Frenchman, Champollion. And I'll tell you about him in a minute. But he didn't do it by himself. An Englishman really started the job, Thomas Young. And the British like to say that Thomas Young deciphered the Rosetta Stone. So let me tell you about their contributions, and you can decide for yourself. Thomas Young was an amazing genius. He was a physician, trained as a physician, who also came up with the theory of light, right, studied light, physicist. But he loved languages. That's what he loved most. And as his escape, he set it as his task to decipher ancient Egyptian language. And when the Rosetta Stone was found, he started working. Right? Now, his first big leap. Right? 1798, someone had suggested that the kings of Egypt wrote their names in ovals. They had seen ovals carved on the walls with hieroglyphs inside the oval. And they thought that that was the king's names inside. They didn't know for sure. They couldn't read it. But they thought it appeared about right to have a king's name, you know, long enough for a name, frequently enough. So there was a suggestion that the king's names were written in ovals. And they're called cartouches to this day. You know why? Because of Napoleon's expedition. When the men saw these ovals, they said they looked like bullets, right? Standing on their end, a bullet. Imagine a bullet as an oval, kind of, with a little line on the bottom. And they said, oh, that's a cartouche. That's the French word for bullet. Right? So that's why we call them cartouches today, because of Napoleon soldiers. Now, it had been suggested that the cartouches contained the names of the kings. Thomas Young figured, you know, names can't be picture writing. You can't have a picture, for example, of King Ptolemy. Now, understand this. We have the Greek text on the bottom, right? And the first line of the Greek text, very first line, first two words, Ptolemeu Basileu, King Ptolemy. So the Greek let us know Ptolemy's name is on the Rosetta Stone. Young figured, huh, in the cartouche? Those are going to be the letters of Ptolemy's name. And he started thinking it out. He said, ah, there's a little rectangle. That's a hieroglyph. That must be the P. There's a semicircle. That must be the T. There's a loop, like a lasso. That must be the O. There's an owl. Might be an M, right? Or a stand. There's two ways of writing the M. And he went through it. And he worked out the name Ptolemus, the Greek version of Ptolemy. So Thomas Young is one of the first ones to say, you've got an alphabet here. We can figure out the names. Now, often it is said, by the way, that Cleopatra's name is on the Rosetta Stone. It's not. Only Ptolemy's appear. Later they found another inscription with Cleopatra's name and they used that too. But the important thing to remember is Young figures out, aha, we've got an alphabet, just like ours. Then enter Jean-François Champollion. Champollion was an amazing kid, and I mean kid. His father was a librarian, and Champollion was used to playing in the stacks, in the books. And he always, as a little kid, even crawling around, he was looking at different languages on the spines of the books, trying to understand what they were, and he became almost obsessed with languages. By the time he was like 14 or 15, he knew eight languages. One of the languages that he knew was Coptic. Coptic had survived. You see, the Copts still exists today in Egypt. And they have a church, the Coptic Church. And if you go to the Coptic Church, I sometimes, when I'm in Egypt, I often do it, I'll stop into a Coptic church and listen to the service. Because when you hear it, you're hearing ancient Egyptian. They've kept the language right through. So Coptic is really our connection with spoken ancient Egyptian. And Champollion knew Coptic. Now, think about this. Thomas Young says it's an alphabet. Great. So we can look at the hieroglyphs and know how it sounded. But that doesn't tell us what it means. For example, you know the hieroglyph that everybody is familiar with? An ankh. It's like a cross. It has the loop at the top, comes down, crossbar. That's an ankh. People often wear them as good luck symbols. Everybody knew that that was pronounced ankh. The ancient Egyptians pronounced it ankh. From the alphabet, we could figure that out. But how do you know that the ancient Egyptians meant by ankh the word life? Right? It's the concept life. The answer is in the Coptic Church's liturgy. We know that ankh means life. So from Coptic, by knowing Coptic, Champollion could look at the hieroglyphs, say it's an alphabet, say it out loud, ankh, and then realize, ah, Coptic has that word, ankh, it means life. So that was the connecting thing that enabled Champollion to decipher hieroglyphs, not just phonetically, but get at the meaning of it. And he was the first one to translate the Rosetta Stone. It didn't come easy, by the way. The Rosetta Stone, discovered in 1799 during the campaign, brought to England in 1801, was not deciphered until 1822. It was a long haul, right? But he finally did it. And for the first time, the records of ancient Egypt could be read, thanks to Napoleon and Champollion. Now, what I'd like to do is to show you how, just how, the language worked. But let me explain what was on the Rosetta Stone. You know, what's on it? What does it say? First, the Rosetta Stone is what we call a stela. A stela is simply a large stone, you know, usually 3, maybe 5, sometimes 9 feet high, shaped like a tombstone. They're always rounded at the top, and I really do think that we get our tombstones from that. I think that's where we get the tombstone from. And these were placed in front of temples. Again, kind of like a bulletin board. If you wanted to announce something, if you wanted to say something great was done, you had a stela carved. And the Rosetta Stone, broken as it is, fragmented as it is, right? It's broken, it's not complete, was from an originally a stela. It was a large stone erected in front of a temple. Now, it was erected during the reign of the king Ptolemy V, a Greek who was ruling Egypt, right? Towards the end of Egyptian civilization. Now, Ptolemy had done a couple of nice things for the priests. He said you don't have to pay certain kinds of taxes. You don't have to make this trip that you always have to make to deposit your taxes. And the priests were very thankful. So what they did was they carved this stela. And they carved it in hieroglyphs because it was important. They carved it in demotic so the people could read it. And they carved it in Greek so Ptolemy V could read it because he couldn't read Egyptian. The Greeks never learned to read Egyptian when they were ruling. The only Greek who ever learned ancient Egyptian language was Cleopatra. We'll talk about that later. So this Rosetta Stone is basically a thank you letter from the priests of Egypt to Ptolemy V saying, thanks a lot, you're a good guy. Given that we now know what the Rosetta Stone said and that it was a key to decipherment, I want to go to my last goal for this lecture. I want you to be able to read and write your own names in hieroglyphs. So to do that, you're going to have to know how the language really works. Now, let me start by saying there are three ways a hieroglyphic symbol, can be used. First, it can be used phonetically to represent a sound. For example, if you take the hieroglyph that looks like a hand hieroglyph, they're not talking about hands. That represents the sound D, a D. If you look at the little rectangle hieroglyph, which, if you remember, was the first hieroglyph in King Ptolemy's name, that's a P. Then you have the little semicircle in Ptolemy's name. That's a T. So those three symbols, the P, the T, and the D, those three, are alphabetic. Just represent a sound. They're not talking about hands and rectangles and semicircles. Now, if we put those three hieroglyphs together, if we form them together, we have a word. D, P, T. The ancient Egyptians didn't write vowels. Many ancient languages don't have vowels. For example, Hebrew did not write the vowels until very late. The reason is that most people were illiterate, and these were just sort of aid memoirs to help you remember things. It wasn't like the formal writing. So, D, P, T. Now, we don't know how exactly it was pronounced, but let's say call it Depit. We'll put it in a little short E so it doesn't sound like Swedish Depit or whatever. So we'll say Depit. That was a word. It's a phonetic word. Three hieroglyphs used phonetically. Now, the next use of a hieroglyph, right? There are three, remember? We're using it phonetically first. I can also, now by the way, the ancient Egyptian word Depit meant boat. It was the word for boat. Now, I can also, if I want to clarify what the hand and the rectangle and the semicircle mean, I could, at the end of that word, add a boat, a little picture of a boat. Now that's helping me make clear what the meaning is. I'm using that hieroglyph like a picture of what it is. Right? So the first three hieroglyphs, the D and the P and the T, say boat, Depit, and the next one helps clarify it. It determines the meaning for me, helps me determine the meaning. That use of a hieroglyph is called a determinative because it helps determine the meaning of a phonetic word. So that's the second way a hieroglyph can be used. After a bunch of phonetic sounds, giving you a picture of what it is. I mean, for example, if I wrote the word C-A-T, cat, and drew a little cat, the C and the A and the T are phonetic, and a little picture of a cat is helping me determine the meaning. So far we have two ways that hieroglyphic sounds can be used, either phonetically or as a determinative to give you a picture. Now, what if I'm in a real hurry? I don't have time to write the D, the P, the T, draw a little boat. I want to get it done quickly. That's my third use of hieroglyphs. I can simply draw a picture of a boat and put a little line under it, a stroke, and that says, it's a picture, that's all you're getting. That's called an ideogram. It's pictorial writing. This shows that I'm just doing it the fastest way I can. I'm giving you a picture. So, three ways you can use a hieroglyph. Three ways. You can use it either phonetically, represent a sound, as a determinative to help you determine the meaning of a phonetic word, or you can just use it like picture writing, like people always thought it was, just a simple drawing. Now, sometimes the ideograms are used, these ideograms of the picture writing, are used when space is limited. You know, you're running out of space. It's sort of like the think at the plan ahead sign where the head runs off. If you're running out of space, you start using these ideograms. Or, for example, on rings. If you wanted to put your name on a ring, which is a small surface, you might not have the room to spell out Montu Hotep Herkepchef or something like that. So you might want to try to do an ideogram of something like the god Montu, a little picture or something like that. You do it in different ways. Right? So three different ways, determined often by, you know, just sort of the circumstances. Now, one thing I should tell you about Egyptian that I think is just neat. It's the only language I know that can be written either from right to left or left to right or top to bottom. They could do it any way they wanted. And the reason is for artistic consideration. Think about a tomb. Let's say you're decorating your tomb and you have a doorway and you want to have a religious inscription over the doorway. You want it to say, may I have all the bread and beer and things good and pure that the gods live on. Now, you could write it either from left to right, or right to left, or if you want it to be really artistic and have it really symmetrical, you could start at the middle of the door and write one inscription from right to left, reading outwards from the middle. You could start the same inscription in the middle going the other way, and you've got this beautiful symmetrical double rendering of this prayer. And that's why they could read it, write it from right to left or left to right for artistic consideration. They were really into symmetry. You know, Egypt is a very symmetrical land. You've got the Nile going down the middle. You've got the desert on both sides. They loved symmetry. They liked balance. And their language was done that way. Also, if you had a narrow space where you wanted to write something, you could write it from top to bottom. Right? Now, if you want to know, how do you read it? How do you know which way to read it? The answer is, you always read towards the mouths of the birds. So you look at the birds, and if the mouth's like this, you read it this way, into the mouth, as if the bird is eating the direction it's going in. So you read always into the mouths of the birds. And that's what always tells you which way to do it. It's never confusing. I know that sometimes it sounds like it might be, but it never is. It's an amazing language. But now, my promise. I said that you would all be able to read and write your names in hieroglyphs before this lecture is over. And here's how we're going to do it. At the end of your outlines is an appendix. I've got the entire Egyptian alphabet for you there. For example, the vulture, the bird, is an A, an A sound. They didn't have full vowels, it's a semi-vowel. You'll see a foot is a B sound. You'll see our friend the hand, you'll see hand is D. You'll see the P, the rectangle, you'll see all of that, you'll see. Now, what I want you to do is take that chart, and using that chart, figure out how your name would be written in hieroglyphs. First, you're going to be missing some letters because some vowels aren't there. As I said, the Egyptians don't have many vowels are missing. Just leave them out. And remember, what you're doing is you're not translating your name. We don't call that translating. You're transliterating. Transliterating is taking the sound of your name. That's all you're going by. You don't care about the meaning of your name. That's translating. You're taking the sound of your name and you're writing it in the Egyptian script. So, for example, if your name is Barbara, the first letter, you'd look for a B, and that's the foot. So the first letter in your name would be a B. Now, no full vowel, but the vulture, the Egyptian vulture, the bird, is an A sound. That's close. So you'd put an A. So you have a foot and a vulture. Then you'd have the mouth sign, a little oval, which is R, B-A-R. And you'd repeat it again, B-A-R, because bar, bar. And at the end, you'd have another vulture. So it would be foot, vulture, mouth, foot, vulture, mouth, vulture would be Barbara. Now, you can all do that for all your names. I want you to try it. It'll be fun. Try it out on friends. Write friends' names. And your homework assignment is to write the names, transliterating them in hieroglyphs, of three famous people. And then show them to someone else with the chart and see if they can figure out who the people you've written are. So that's your homework assignment. The only time I'll give you a homework assignment during the 48 lectures. But that one, I want you to try, and I think you'll find it a lot of fun. So now you should know how the ancient Egyptian language worked, how the Rosetta Stone helped decipher it, and I hope you can write your names in hieroglyphs. I'll see you next time.